I've been receiving mail lately from my undergraduate alma mater encouraging me to attend my 30th reunion. It's a milestone I'd really prefer not to focus on, but there it is. When we get these invitations, it often leads us to take a stroll down memory lane and remember our college days, or get a high school reunion invitation to remember what it was like to be in high school. And we can remember big defining moments, and then maybe we also remember some things that are best described as trivia. Well, what I'm going to share with you is definitely the latter. My college produced an isometric map of campus. That's one of those 3D depictions of a place, and it has all of the buildings rendered in great detail, and you can see all the paths on roads, and you can actually imagine what it all looks like. It was a fine map, but my college roommate and I decided that we could improve upon it. And I have to tell you, it is amazing what you can do with whiteout and a pencil and a little bit of artistic ability. We were never particularly fond of the modernist architecture on campus. So we took care of that and put up some wonderful neo-Gothic collegiate dormitories and a chapel and library. We were never happy that our college had abandoned its football program, so we decided there would be a football stadium. And given the fact that the Colts had slinked out of Baltimore in the dead of night to Indianapolis, we thought maybe they'd come to suburban Boston. And so we have a big stadium that's going to host the Colts. We thought, hey, the space program's kind of cool. So on the edge of campus, we put a launch pad and parked this space shuttle on it. It was all a lot of fun. Now, of course, this did not represent Brandeis University in any way, shape, or form. It imagined what we thought it should be like. It was our vision of a more fun and interesting place. And I share all this with you because it's a reminder that maps aren't simply navigational tools. They can be an expression of aspiration, of power, and yes, indeed, of what the world can be like. Back in the Middle Ages, people often created what are known as mappa mundi, maps of the world. They were a depiction of a sacred geography. One great example from the 16th century has Jerusalem right at the center, like the center of a flower. And there are three petals coming off of it, one for Asia, one for Africa, and one for Europe. Now, by this point in time, the age of exploration was well underway. People knew what the coastlines of the continents looked like in most instances. But this depiction wasn't meant to be used by sailors or explorers. It was meant to show a belief that Jerusalem, the holy sacred city, was supposed to be at the center of creation. Jerusalem, the city of David, the home of the temple, the place where Jesus taught and was crucified and resurrected, was supposed to be, ought to be, the hinge on which the world swung. Jerusalem, of course, is not only a place of great ideals. We know that Jerusalem, too, was a place of human failing. There were grifters there and liars and cheats and adulterers and crooks and all sorts of people that we could criticize. People just like you and me, in other words. It was filled with fallen human sinners. But it was this city, the ideal and the reality, that was lifted up by Heinrich Bunting in the 16th century and was also lifted up in word by John of Patmos back in the first century. This week we continue hearing about the New Jerusalem as it's descending from the heavens. And what do we see? Well, there are some descriptions that weren't included in this morning's lectionary reading. Things about jewels and gold and wonderful things. We hear about its shape and its dimensions, that the city is a perfect cube. That turns out to be very important. Because, as you may have noticed in this morning's lesson, there's a description of some of the things that are not present in the New Jerusalem. First off, no temple. And there's no need for one, we are told. Because God and the Lamb, God and Jesus Christ, are fully present in the New Jerusalem. The Holy of Holies in the old temple was a cube. Now the New Jerusalem will be the Holy of Holies. Now this idea seemed crazy, off the wall, hard to comprehend to people in the first century. They knew how important the temple had been in the life of the Jewish people. And this was true, too, of those in the Jewish community who followed Jesus. And the Gentiles who came into the community knew how the temple had been so central. So people believed that when Jerusalem, which had been destroyed by the Romans, was restored, there would be a new temple. John says, no need for that. And that's not the only thing we can dispense with. No need for the sun, the moon, the stars, all gone. Because with God's presence, all will be illuminated. Now, we all know that this is meant to be allegorical. These are images. God's not going to make the sun go away. We will still be able to enjoy sunrises and gazing at the constellations. But think about what this imagery means, what it signifies. All of the shadows that fall over our lives, removed. In the New Jerusalem, no anxiety, no persecution, no poverty, no hunger, no alienation, no war. This will be a place that draws in people from all corners of the earth, a place where all who want to walk with God will be welcome. Think about that. Now, looking at current events today, we might think this vision seems about as preposterous as a world without the sun or the moon or the stars. But John would have us know otherwise. The fact is, at least as the universe is currently constituted, we cannot exist without the sun. We need it. I think we'll all agree on that. But we don't need poverty. We don't need persecution. We don't need oppression. We don't need prejudice. We don't need war. We can choose to do something about those. John's not talking about some future. He's talking about an unfolding present. If you don't believe that, then I have a question for you to ponder. Why are you here today? If we don't believe the promises of God, if we don't believe in the vision for a redeemed creation, why are we here? Especially during the season of Easter. Just a few weeks ago, we proclaimed the resurrection. We said that all of this stuff was beginning to happen. Now, already, it's here. The New Jerusalem has arrived. Now, admittedly, it doesn't look quite like the one described in the book of Revelation. But I've been to the New Jerusalem. And I bet if you think about it, all of you have been there too. Maybe volunteering at WISE, helping women and children in crisis and need. Maybe delivering food to our friends over at Headrest, where people are trying to overcome addiction. Maybe getting on an airplane and going down to San Jose Villanueva and building a house or working on a water project. And not only helping people in a faraway community have a better life, but also being changed by the experience. Maybe you came to the New Jerusalem just last Sunday right in our parish hall when we serve the community dinner. The New Jerusalem is built slowly, brick by brick. Think about how the Grand Canyon came to be. You know, the little trickle of water started flowing slowly, and it picked up steam, and before you know it, we've got a natural wonder. The New Jerusalem is something that we are all invited, indeed we are all called to build. If we're going to be followers of Jesus, we are called to do this. Just as important as coming to Sunday morning worship and singing the hymns and coming to this table and sharing the bread and the cup is going out and doing what Jesus commanded us to do, to take care of the poor, to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to comfort the widow and the orphan, to pay attention to the prisoner, the refugee, the outcast. We don't need a piece of paper. We don't need a map to do this. We have our marching orders, and we have the way. All we need to do is follow Jesus. And if we do that, we will be able to create a sacred geography. We don't have to wait till tomorrow to do it. We can start right now. So what are we waiting for?